Hi everyone and welcome to the Student Lawyer podcast series. Whether you're at school, sixth form, university, thinking about studying law or exploring law careers, you're in the right place. We are the one-stop shop for student lawyers.
Welcome to the Student Lawyer podcast. My name is Camilla and I'm a law graduate currently applying for training contracts. In this episode, I'm joined by Abimbola Johnson, who is a crime and regulatory barrister at 25 Bedford Row. Abby was called to the bar in 2011. Abimbola, I came across your profile on LinkedIn by reading a post you wrote in which you emphasised the fact that most barristers face a period of rejection, failure and setback. I think that's a really important message to share with those who are seeking a career at the bar, and one that I really want to share with our listeners. So thank you for agreeing to be a guest on today's episode to share your story with us. Welcome.
No problem. You can call me Abby, by the way.
Abby. Okay.
It's quite a wordy thing to say.
Thank you, Abby. So I've got a few questions for you today, so let's get straight into it. But Abby, what was your journey like to securing pupillage? Did you know, how many rounds did it take you, rejections, all that sort of thing?
Yeah, so I was actually very lucky. So my journey to securing pupillage was quite a smooth one, which I think is why when I then didn't secure tenancy, first of all, time round, it came as quite a shock. So yeah, I went straight from school to university. I did take a year out after uni to do some paralegaling, and that was mostly because I knew that I wanted to do crime, but I wanted to make sure that I was being realistic about wanting to do crime, because the first thing anyone says to you when you tell them that you want to be a criminal barrister is that you're mad because you won't make any money and the hours are horrible and so on and so forth. So I needed to make sure it was an informed decision. So I worked for a few months in a high street firm called Lansbury Worthington, and I also worked in a kind of like more private client geared firm called Kingsley Napley for a few months in each, and did some mini pupillages as well, and that really secured my decision, firmed up my decision. So during that year, so before applying for bar school and pupillages, I applied for scholarships and pupillage. So I was very lucky that I actually had four pupillage offers the first time I applied for pupillage.
Oh, well, brilliant.
Yeah, so I went into bar school with pupillage secured and with a major exhibition from the Inner Temple as well.
Oh, fantastic.
Which covered my fees. Yeah, very, very lucky, very smooth for that part of the journey anyway.
So for those making applications currently or whenever the application process is open, what do you have any tips for those? Obviously you're doing something right to get four offers.
Yeah, I think so. The way that I approached it back then, to be honest, I think the approach that I would take would be quite similar now anyway. The way that I approached it was I genuinely just went on to Chambers and Partners, and I looked at the area of law that I knew I predominantly wanted my practice to be in, which was crime. And I only applied to the top 10 sets that were listed on Chambers and Partners, because the reality was, despite having paralegaled at two firms, I didn't really know that many people at the criminal bar. But what I did know was that if I was going to practice in an area like crime, which, like I said before, it's not the area of law that you go to if you want to make loads and loads of money. Mm-hmm. But you have to be very careful, I think, with human interest areas of law, which tend to, on the face of it, pay less than, say, the commercial bar and so on. So I knew the quality of set that I wanted to go to needed to be high so that I could guarantee that I would receive a decent amount of money, even if it wasn't going to be a huge amount of money. And to be perfectly honest, that was a factor which was important to me. The background I come from, I'm very lucky. I went to private school, I went to Oxford and so on. But I'm also from a single parent household. My mum has my brother who's almost 7 years younger than me. So she was still financially responsible for him. And I didn't want to be in a position where I required or leaned too hard on family help for money. So I wanted to make sure that I was going into something which was financially viable. And so for me, the best way was to look at rankings and just to see who was objectively marked out as being a top set within that area. So I drew that as a parameter and said to myself, if I'm going to go into crime, I want to go to a set that I know is objectively really, really good, of a really high standard, and I'm going to have to work hard to make sure that I meet those standards when I make my applications. So I think you need to first of all think about what your boundaries are, how far you want to go in your search for pupillage. Is there a line that you're going to draw objectively about where you want to end up, where you don't want to end up, and only apply to the sets that meet that criteria, so that you know you're really concentrating your efforts on places that you definitely want to be at? Because pupillage is a really hard slog. It's very, invests a lot of emotions, a lot of time, a lot of energy into it. So you need to make sure that the prize of tenancy at that set is something that is really worth striving for, because there'll be moments where you really doubt on your journey if it's worth it. So you need to have that objective measure. The second thing that I'd say is do further research. So looking on things like Chambers and Partners, they're a great start. But obviously, then if you can contact people from those sets of chambers or people who know about those sets of chambers, whether it's the types of solicitors that would instruct them, whether it's actual members of those chambers, speak to them if you can. I know that can be really difficult, but I think if anything, actually, since the year that I was applying, which would have been 2010, because I'm that old, since then things have developed, and Chambers websites are really thorough, very full, updated very regularly, and they give you a really good idea of the types of cases that each set of chambers is involved in. I think that Chambers Twitter feed can give you a good idea of how they present themselves, because often with a Twitter feed, they don't just tweet about the cases that they're involved in. They may also tweet about causes that they're interested in, projects that they're working on, and so on. So it gives you an idea of the ethos of that set of chambers as well. I would also have a look at the Twitter feeds, the LinkedIn profiles of a range of tenants from that set of chambers. Have a look at a few silks, have a look at the senior juniors, and have a look at the junior juniors, the people who are closer in line with the level of practice that you would be entering into if you were to become a tenant. And that gives you, again, an idea of the personalities, of the characters of the people at that set. And really consider what it is that you want out of pupillage. So think about things like, what sort of level of pupillage award do you need? Do you want to be somewhere where you can draw down the award during bar school, or are you okay with waiting until you start pupillage to get that? What sort of geographical areas do they practice in? Do you definitely want to be in London? Are you happy being on the circuit and so on? The work-life balance sometimes is better on the circuit than it is in London. So aspects like that, and I think it's just really about making sure that you really know yourself and that you know where you want to apply to. And then in terms of the actual substantive applications themselves, I'd say they really need to reflect that you have properly researched that set of chambers. So put in those facts, put in those things that you've seen on their Twitter pages, put in those cases that you have noticed on their chambers page. But also remember that your pupillage application is your written advocacy about yourself. So it's really your chance to showcase those soft skills, those extra nuggets of information about yourself, which make you that little bit more interesting. Because when you then get through to an interview, some of those questions are going to be steered by the content that you've put into your application forms. So that's your opportunity to really bring out those gems and those little nuggets of information that you would like to expand upon during your interviews. So I hope that's helpful.
Brilliant. No, that sounds like fantastic advice. And I really like the fact that you actually mentioned the financial side of things as well, because I think that's something that not a lot of people mention, but it is, you have to be realistic. Yeah.
Sure. And I think women in particular, I think just, you know, in this country, we're not great about talking about money. No, and as a profession, sure, we are terrible about talking about money. I've lost count of the times that I've gone to court, you know, and I'm coming into my 10th year of qualification on a private case, and I don't know how much I've been billed out for. Right. And, you know, that's not a particularly structured way to approach your practice. So I think that is something that people should have at the front of their minds right from the beginning.
Yeah.
Because you really do, like, finances are a huge source of stress.
Definitely,
right at the beginning,
I agree,
of your career, and you know the impact that it has on you mentally, even physically, it's really, I think it's something you should put at the forefront of your mind so that you're really prepared for it when you go into pupillage.
Brilliant, thank you. So as someone who does understand the pupillage recruitment process, how important do you think excellent academics are? Can a candidate realistically make up for less than perfect A-levels if they get their 2-1, you know, fill out their CV with good work experience and extracurriculars? What's your opinion on that?
I think obviously if you can strive for excellent academics, yeah, that should always be your target.
Right.
If anything happens which prevents you from reaching that is not necessarily a bar to you being able to come to the bar.
Right.
So to give you an example, when we do our sifting exercise at 25, every member of Chambers participates in that. So we each get 4, 5, maybe 6, depending on the number of people who've applied that year, mm-hmm. Applications to read through, and we are put into pairs. We mark them blind, so we can't see the names or the ages of the candidates that we are looking at, and we just look at the application itself. And we have 5 criteria that we mark them against, each of which is equally weighted. So education is one, work experience is another, commitment to the bar, and then your response to chamber-specific questions. So that's 4 criteria. So actually, when you think about it, you can make up for maybe average or slightly below average achievements academically if you have really stellar work experience, really stellar commitment to the bar, if you've shown that you've really researched the questions that we have raised, which tend to be questions about a case which has just happened, or a legal development. So you can show that you have that acumen and that ability to make it at the bar through other avenues. So I think not having the best education, it definitely will make it slightly trickier for you than somebody who has perfect education. But in the same way that having straight A stars won't guarantee that you'll get pupillage, not having straight A stars is not an automatic bar to you being able to secure pupillage either.
Brilliant. I'm sure that will make a lot of people, make them feel reassured anyway.
I think the other thing I should say, it does depend on the area of law that you want to go into. Some areas I would say are very academically rigorous, mm-hmm. whereas others are more interested in the sort of holistic approach towards the bar. So if I give you an example, if you were to go into something which is like pure, like very, very highly academic area of law, where really you're just writing advices, where it's going to be very technical, I don't know, like maybe tax, for example.
Right.
I'd imagine the emphasis on academics is quite high. Whereas if you're going into something like the areas that I do, crime, professional regulatory work, or other human-centric areas, immigration, some aspects of family law and so on, you still need to be strong academically. But in many ways, actually, your interaction and your emotional intelligence is more important, because you could be a straight A student, but if you're unable to connect with somebody and to get instructions from them and make them feel at ease when you represent them in court, you're not going to get very far at the bar.
That makes a lot of sense.
And the other thing to think about is what stage of life you're at as well. So if you are straight out of university and you are applying with less work experience, and obviously your academics are going to be emphasised a lot more, but if you'd gone to university 10 years ago and you've done lots of things since then and lots of very impressive things since then obviously those are going to carry a lot of weight, and you're less likely to concentrate on the fact that this person maybe got a 2-2 or lower at university.
Brilliant. Okay, thank you. When you get to that interview stage, do you have any top tips for how candidates can shine during the interview?
Yeah, so I would say it's similar to the way that you'd prepare in the first place to writing the application. So I'd say, first of all, make sure that you go back to the application that you've written, because that's going to be something that each of your panelists would have considered before you walk in that door. And that would inform how they are going to approach you during your interview. It gives them an idea of what interests you have. It gives them an idea of what your background is in terms of career and education and so on. So make sure that you read that back. They might ask you questions, they might develop points from your application form. Think about whether or not there are new things that you've done since you completed your application form that you want to bring out in your interview. And then again, it's going onto the websites, having a look, seeing what those chambers are about, so you can focus your mind and really tailor your answers, tailor the way that you approach things towards the kind of outlook that that chambers has, and the way that chambers presents itself. But also think about the areas of law that you are working towards qualifying into, and make sure that you're on top of current affairs. Very often in the first round of the interview, because we recognise that a lot of the people who are applying are pre-bar school, we try to level the playing field as much as possible by making the questions easily accessible to anyone who has had bar school training or hasn't. So the way to do that, obviously, is to look at things like current news, but also just kind of wanting to really dig into how logical your answers are, what your reasoning is behind the conclusions that you have come to. And I would also say, and I think this is something that we very often see with candidates, we try our best when we see somebody who's going slightly wrong in an interview, we try our best to steer them towards the right answer. So I think sometimes people think when they're being interviewed, the interviewer is trying to trip them up when right. they question them. And when they say things like, well, are you sure that that's the sentence that you want to put yeah. forward? Because, I mean, they stole a loaf of bread. Do you really want to remand them in custody and give them a 2-year sentence?
yeah.
That kind of thing. So, and I think very often candidates think that we're just trying to trip them up. But actually, no, we're not. We recognise that you have a limited time to read the papers, that you're nervous right. when you come through the door. What we want to know is, we want to see, can this person listen to judgment? Can they take criticism? Can they take that on board? And are they able to pivot their argument? Are they able to read the room, read the tribunal? So I'd say listen to the kinds of things, the prods that you're getting from your interview panel, because they might actually be trying to steer you towards the right answer.
That's helpful to know. I was just thinking in my sort of mind when you were saying that the other advice that I've heard is that, you know, people will try to push you to see whether you can stand your ground on an argument as well. So I think for me, it would maybe be a bit like, which one are they trying to do here?
It's hard. It is hard to know. It is really tricky. I have yeah. a couple of mentees, and this comes up all the time,
right?
Where we kind of do a debrief after the interview, and they're like, oh my god, Abby, do you think that I should have changed the answer? Do you think I should have stuck? And sometimes I'm like, no, that answer was definitely wrong, and you should have changed Aww. It. And other times I'm like, no, that was the right answer. They're just trying to push you.
Yeah.
I think it's one of those things that you will get used to mm-hmm. As you, the more you interview, the more you'll get used to it. I think really you sort of know, because it's you know, it's not too dissimilar from when you're in the classroom and you answer a question from a teacher, and the teacher says, oh, what about this? Or what about that? Or are you sure about this? Or are you sure about that? I think you just listen to the question, go back to your reasoning behind your answer, and think, oh, may I have been wrong? Might I have read the wrong thing? And if you do think you have the right answer, then, you know, crack on with it. But I think just don't approach it on the basis that you think they're only going to intervene to try to trip you up.
Right. Okay.
Be open to the idea that maybe they're steering you towards the right answer.
That definitely helps clarify. Thank you. Okay, so yeah, moving on to what I mentioned really at the beginning, which was that, you know, the reason I came across your profile was because you had sort of talked about trials and tribulations in your career. So just for listeners who might not be aware of that, that's that you did not secure tenancy at the first set of chambers that you were at. So that must have been a really difficult time. How did you overcome this setback, and what advice would you give to anyone who finds themselves in a similar situation?
Yeah, so that was really tricky. I have to say, like, I am honestly fully over it. It was a really long time ago that I was thinking about it, because yeah. of the fact this is obviously around the time that people get their tenancy decisions or their pupillage decisions. And I think the first thing to remember is that as a profession, I think it's very, very rare to come across anyone at the bar or anyone who's a solicitor who has not been rejected from something during the course of their career, whether that's back at university, not getting into the university they wanted to get into, whether that is not getting the training contract or the pupillage offer that they had set their sights on, or not getting the scholarship that they had wanted from their Inns of Court, to not securing tenancy. And I think the other side of it is that similarly, both sides of the profession are really bad about talking about the fact that we have all been rejected. And I think that's because we are each personally, especially barristers, we're each our own brand ambassador. We want to be seen as being quite infallible. We want to be seen as being people who can be trusted to be right about everything when you ask for our advice. And so we don't really like owning up to any weaknesses that we have. But the other side of that is it makes it seem as though if you do have a rejection, you're suddenly not good enough to be in the profession. But the reality is that we all face it. For me, overall, I think looking back at it, it was a positive experience. At the time, it was really tricky to come through. It was made especially difficult because there were four of us in my intake that year, and the four of us were quite tight and still are. And I was the only person that wasn't taken on. So the other three were, and I was the only one that was rejected. And then on top of that, so we were all away from the physical building of the chambers that I was at. And we got called to go back to chambers to receive our decisions so we could receive it in person. And the thing which made it extra tricky was that they had a champagne reception, or like a champagne party, for the other three. And so I had to go from being rejected to walking downstairs to the bar next to chambers, where, you know, people from chambers, a few solicitors and so on were congratulating my colleagues. And obviously I was really happy for them, but internally I was devastated. I think I lasted about 10 minutes before I just had to leave because it was just so difficult. And I just left and burst into tears and I cried all the way home. And then I had to keep going into chambers for about another month or so while I was interviewing elsewhere to secure another pupillage. And it was really tricky because I didn't know who'd voted for me. I didn't know who'd voted against, and I felt out of place. But it was a real wake-up call at the same time, because I think if I'm very honest with myself, I had found the journey very easy. And it's not that I'd become complacent, but it meant that I hadn't really had any moment in my career where I had to stop and really think about why I wanted to be a barrister. I had sort of decided I was going to be a barrister from a very, very young age. I had completed all these steps along my journey. I hadn't really faced any obstacles, and I just kind of was going along, and everything was rosy and everything was fine. So it gave me a real opportunity to recalibrate and really consider what I wanted to do. And I think that actually in the end, it meant that I ended up at a set that ultimately is much more suited to the practice that I want to have and have now. Yeah. But also just little things like the personalities that that are around me. I loved everyone at my previous set. I actually didn't dislike anybody. But I can't quite put my finger on it, but 25 Bedford Road just felt like home the moment I got there. So I'm actually quite happy that it panned out the way that it did. The hardest bit, strangely, was that I think the bar is quite unique. So it was really difficult to explain to my friends and family what happened and why I'd been rejected and why I wasn't taken on yet. And because, you know, in the normal course of events in other careers, you'd have to do something quite bad to not be taken on after being somewhere for like 16 to 18 months. You know, something quite significant would have needed to have gone wrong. So trying to explain to them that it wasn't, you know, I was like, no, I'm not. I was like, no, they're not saying that they think I'm a terrible person. I can't be embarrassed. They just don't want me there. And they were just like, what? And I was like, yeah, I don't. I was like, what was the reason? Like, well, you don't really get reasons. They're like, what? I was like, I know, it's quite strange. But, you know, and I think things have developed as well. The bar is quite behind in the way that it approaches these things. I don't think that we are as transparent as we ought to be. That applies to most sets of chambers. I think we have a long way to go, but I think also the experience that I had about 10 years ago, I don't think it's quite as bad now.
Okay.
I think it's similar. I'm not going to say that we've progressed a lot. We've still got a long way to go, but I think people are quite aware now. that there are things we can improve and there are things being done to try to resolve that.
That's good. I think it's great that you're, like I said, that you're sort of talking about these sort of things on social media anyway, so people who are, you know, going through the process can realise that, you know, rejection is something that everyone experiences.
Exactly.
So, you know, that being the case, it's still really hard at times to remember not to take it personally and not to let it affect your confidence. Do you have any advice for our listeners on how can just feel a bit more confident and avoid thinking they're not good enough for the bar, you know, quote unquote?
Yeah. I think the best thing to do is to make sure that you are being realistic about your applications, because I think, unfortunately, there will be people who are being rejected because they aren't objectively good enough to go to the bar. And a fault that we have with the process is that I think sometimes the standards for getting into bar school, they're not the same as the standards that you need to actually become a barrister. So you end up spending tens of thousands of pounds on tuition fees for bar school. And actually quite a few people who complete the course don't have any prospects of getting pupillage. So it's against that background, as you say, Camilla, it can be really difficult to know, am I somebody who falls into the kind of delusional category, or am I somebody who simply has been unlucky with this round? So I think the best thing to do is just to make sure that you have somebody who is connected to the profession, who can just give you some very frank feedback about what your prospects are. So getting a mentor, getting somebody who'll take the time out to listen to you. And, you know, the good thing about this pandemic is, frankly, as a profession, we have more time to do that kind of thing. I mean, if you know, I've done, during lockdown, I have produced a podcast series, I have appeared on a few webinars, I'm on this today, I'm recording a couple more webinars in the next couple of weeks. We all have a little bit more time to give back. And I think that in general, actually, as barristers, because we have all been through that, as I say, rejection, been through that process, that period of self-doubt, if somebody approaches you in the right way, in general, we will make the time to listen to somebody and to give them that feedback. So I would say reach out to barristers if you're able to. If you don't have that level of connection with individual members of the bar, there's nothing wrong with joining one of the Inns of Court. In fact, I would actually encourage people to do that. Join one of the four Inns of Court, that's Inner Temple, Middle Temple, Grays or Lincoln's. And very often they can put you in touch with somebody who can give you that feedback, because obviously the barrister receives an email from somebody in the Temple saying, hi, we've got this candidate and they just want somebody to look at their application form. Are you happy to do that? They're more inclined to take notice of that. So I would say just try to find somebody who can objectively consider your application and just give you some really frank feedback. I do that a few times a week. I get messaged on LinkedIn by various people asking me to look at things, and if I have the time, I will. If I don't, I'll say, I'm sorry, I don't have the time, but here's some general advice I can give to people. And then in terms of actually just navigating the rejection, I would say just always take a step back sometimes, you know, just... there's nothing wrong with taking some time out and, I don't know, going traveling or just working in a bar and having some fun instead of thinking I really need to do this so I can add it to my pupillage portal application. Just be a normal person for a few weeks or months in a year if that's what you need to get your head back in the right space, and that's fine.
Brilliant, thank you. So you mentioned about mentors. With the solicitor side, I know that there's aspiring solicitors and places like that you can go to kind of get paired up with mentors. Is there anything like that at the bar, or would you just say it's the Inns of Court?
Yeah, so there's the Inns of Court. There's also various smaller groups. What I would say is it's quite ironic, because I think once you're at the bar, it's really easy to know what those groups are and who to contact.
Okay.
When you're a student, it's much harder. So I'd say, yeah, the four Inns of Court are a good place to start. If you're actually at bar school, then speaking to whoever teaches you the particular module that you then want to practice in, approaching them, because many of them are either current or former practitioners. They might have connections to a chambers or to a firm to put you in touch with somebody through that mechanism. Other than that, so for example, if you want to go into crime, there's a criminal bar association that you can contact. There is the Young Legal Aid Lawyers Group. There's places like the Howard League for Penal Reform. There's the Women in Criminal Law Group. There's the Black Barristers Network. There's various of these sort of groups that you can get in touch with and speak to them about their mentoring programs and how you could get enrolled onto those. There's quite a few of those. Checking out the websites for the Inns of Court is a good idea because a lot of those groups will advertise on those. And then also checking out the circuits websites. So for example, London's part of the South Eastern Circuit. So if you go onto the SEC website,
okay,
and have a look on there, then sometimes they have details of the groups that you can get in touch with about mentoring. And if not, whoever is the secretary or, you know, the general point of contact for those circuits may be able to recommend people. And like I say, they may be able to contact people on your behalf. And when they've got that official stamp behind their email, it's easier to get people on board to reply to you. These things can be tricky. You've got to be a bit bold. And to be honest, if you're going to be a barrister, you've got to be bold anyway. So think of it as a sort of first step in advocacy.
Training. Brilliant. Thank you. Just to add on to that, at the Student Lawyer, we are setting up a mentorship scheme that we're creating to help improve diversity. We're kind of finalising the details of that at the moment. But if any listeners do want to sign up to the waiting list, then just pop over to thestudentlawyer.com where you can sign up to the waiting list or email hello@thestudentlawyer.com. Okay, Abby, so how do you balance your workload and relaxation time? Is that possible at the bar? Do you have any tips for listeners regarding that?
Yeah, I think it is possible. I think it's much harder at the beginning of your career, definitely.
Okay.
Because a lot of the first few years of practice and it's all about kind of just grafting and just being constantly available, because you never know what piece of work is going to land with whom, what impression it's going to make. Some of the work that I get and the biggest cases that I have had have been from things which I thought were just completely innocuous at the beginning. It could be that it's things like I replied to an attendance note or I provided an attendance note after hearing really promptly and this particular solicitor really enjoyed that I did that. Or I've done a magistrate's court trial as a favour to somebody when I meant to be on papers that day, but I go out and do that. And then as a result, the solicitor says, well, that's great. I can't believe that somebody of that level of call went to the mags court, did all this work, did all this prep for this client. I'm going to give them a Crown Court trial as a result. So you need to find that balance of kind of making yourself available, putting a lot of graft work in, and you know, some like loss leading work as well, stuff where you're working really hard on something that ultimately doesn't pay very much in the hope that it will lead to something else. What I would say is the profession has peaks and troughs. There's some times where you'll be really, really busy and there'll be other times when it's a lot more quiet. And I would say the way to balance is to enjoy the times which are quiet rather than stressing about the fact that it's quiet and that you don't have that much money coming in, because you never know when you're going to have another quiet period again, and the next time you're busy you're going to be wishing that you just enjoyed that opportunity to, you know, cook dinner rather than microwaving something and so on. So I would say just take your time with enjoying the natural opportunities that you have to relax, and that as you get more senior you will be able to argue to have more downtime, but you just need to be very tactical about the way that you approach it with your clerks and with your solicitors. Give as much notice as you can. Be reasonable about what you want. So look at your diary, look ahead at your diary, make sure that you're caught up in all of the work and paperwork so you're not leaving anybody on the lurch. Say to people, you know, if you can, like these people, look, I'm going to be away next month. So if you want anything done, let me know now and I'll get it done. so that next month you actually have that time away and that time off. But also well-being is something which is much more at the forefront of people's minds at the bar. So at 25 Bedford Row, we have a policy now where people can mark out hours in the day where they will not reply to work emails, and that's supported by everyone throughout Chambers. So you just put it as a footer in your email and say, I don't check my emails between this time, I don't expect a response from you between these times, even if I email you. And it just fosters that kind of goodwill, so you can mark those boundaries out and just keep your work and your personal life a bit more balanced.
That's great. I think that's really important to set boundaries, and that's, yeah, it's amazing that you can do that. So what's just going to some, you know, what do you enjoy most about being a barrister? Are there any career highlights that you'd like to share with us?
Okay, so what do I enjoy most about being a barrister? I think, should I just be really honest?
Yes. We love honesty here at The Student Lawyer.
I think what I really enjoy most about being a barrister is, like, say I'm going out on a night out or something and I'm really dressed up.
Yeah.
And like someone's like, oh, so what do you do? And I'm like, I'm a barrister. And they kind of look at me like, oh my gosh, really? Are you? They're like, oh, but you're like, you look quite normal. And I'm just like, yes, I know. They're like, that's amazing. And I'm like, yes, I am amazing. I'm a barrister. I think that's kind of the best thing.
I love the best thing about being a barrister.
It's ridiculous. But yeah, I think it's a bragging right. I think, yeah. But on a turning that into like a serious answer, I think it's really nice to be a member of a profession that's so well respected.
Yeah.
And I think it's a reminder that you're very lucky to do what you do in many ways. That you're part of a community that has very high standing, and that people really rely on, people recognise as something which is difficult to get into, something which is difficult to maintain. I like the fact that it comes with such positive connotations about you. I think it's a real privilege to be able to call yourself a member of that type of profession, same for solicitors as well. So that is generally something that keeps me going. I think when I have quite difficult moments, I think, oh, but you know what, actually it's just really cool being a barrister, and it's really nice to, you're working this hard for something that people do actually respect. And so that does kind of make you want to strive on, make you want to continue developing your practice and hopefully getting towards the top of the profession and so on. So yeah, I think it's a bragging right.
That's a huge accomplishment, and definitely something that you can obviously be proud of. So I think that really means a lot, doesn't it? If you wake up in the morning and think, yeah, I'm a barrister.
Yeah, exactly. It's cool. My husband always teases me about the fact that I can't go longer than about 10 minutes of meeting somebody without dropping into conversation that I'm a barrister.
That's funny, yeah, actually. That's funny. My sister was telling me the other day about, I'm vegan, so we kind of like to do the same thing. I think there's a meme on Instagram somewhere that said, oh, during lockdown, I haven't been able to tell anyone I'm a vegan for, you know, 2 months. So maybe you feel the same about being a barrister.
Imagine if someone were a vegan barrister.
Wow. Oh my God. We need to find one. I need to interview one.
Oh gosh.
Okay, so Abby, one last question before we let you go. Yeah. What is one thing that you wish you could go back in time and tell yourself at the beginning of your career?
Oh, do you know what? I think if I were to go back, what would I do? This is a tricky one because just in case people don't know, you actually sent me these questions in advance so I could think about them, and I still haven't thought of a specific thing that I would do. I think, honestly, I would tell myself to take a bit more time before going into the profession.
Okay.
Because I think being a barrister is something you can definitely do a little bit later without any prejudice. It's not something that you need to go into straight away. You know, I when it got into the profession at 21, 20, 22, and actually some of the best barristers that I know or people who've kind of like lived their lives, done other things, seen more of the world than I had at that age or even have now, and then they've gone into it because they bring that real life experience, they bring that maturity and so on into it, they bring that extra kind of level of professionalism. I think it helps, and so I think I might say maybe have a bit more fun before going into it. I wish I'd taken that gap year and, you know, traveled around Africa like all of my friends from uni did, and, you know, come back with like blankets that I then very patronizingly explained they're like of origin of, and how I'd met like this like really remote group of people and I'd learned so much from them, like, you know, so you sort of have like things like that. It would have been cool to have traveled a bit more, just had a bit more fun, just enjoyed those years before going into the profession, because it would always have been there, you know.
I think that's great advice, because I know I expect that when you're at university and you've got friends that are maybe getting pupillages, training contracts, you might feel in a rush to keep up with them. But yeah, exactly. I think not having that pressure on yourself is, yeah, really great advice. So brilliant. Yeah. Thank you. So yeah, thank you for joining us today and spending your time, sharing your wisdom. So brilliant. Thank you very much.
No problem, Camilla. Thank you so much for having me. Bye.
Take care. Bye.
For more student lawyer information, commercial awareness quizzes and interviews, head over to thestudentlawyer.com. If you're a student lawyer who is interested in becoming part of the team, email us at hello@studentlawyer.com.